Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Inside Scoop Live. Thanks for tuning in. I'm your host, Juanita Watson, and today, child psychologist Dr. Lori Zellinger is joining us. She is going to be talking about her new book, The Oh My in Tonsillectomy and Adenoidectomy, How to Prepare Your Child for Surgery. Now, this book has just been released on Loving Healing Press. Dr. Lori Zellinger's interest in children dates back to her babysitting days, which really became the foundation of her later pursuit of school psychology and play therapy. During the course of her career, Dr. Zellinger and her psychologist husband raised 4 sons. As parents, they learned firsthand the difference between reading about children and living with them. Her new book represents their experience with their son's tonsillectomy, as well as her hope that others will benefit from the information. Her concept of preparing a child for surgery is based upon the premise that information and preparation will reduce anxiety and help families to better manage their experience. Dr. Zellinger earned her master's degree and professional diploma from Queen's College over 30 years ago, and later went on to earn her doctoral degree from Hofstra University. She writes a humor column that was developed for the quarterly newsletter of the New York State Association for Play Therapy called Grin and Share It. She is also a media referral specialist for the American Psychological Association and media ambassador and information officer for the New York State Psychological Association, where she holds the position of chair of the Task Force on Child and Adolescent Issues. Dr. Zellinger's ongoing devotion to children continues in her role as full-time school psychologist for the Oceanside Public School District in New York, as well as a private practice licensed psychologist and registered play therapist supervisor. She works and lives on Long Island, New York, and you can find more about the doctor through her website, drzellinger.com. So with that said, welcome to the program, Dr. Zellinger.
Thanks so much, Juanita. I'm really delighted to be here.
Wonderful. And I'm going to call you Lori, if that's okay.
I would prefer it.
Okay. Wonderful. Well, I am really interested in hearing about the experience that you actually had with your son, Jordan, that was kind of the instigator for this book.
Let me start, I guess, by telling you first that I'm a mom. So I really define myself, I guess, as a mother first, and I happen to be a psychologist and a school psychologist and some of the other things that you mentioned. But I ended up writing about it because as a mom, I needed to figure out how we were going to get through the procedure. In fact, the title of the book, The Oh My in Tonsillectomy and Adenoidectomy, if you look at the cover of the book, the tonsillect oh me is really oh my.
Oh my. Mm-hmm.
Right. So they're really supposed to be a tongue-in-cheek, sort of reference there.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was my feeling. When I heard about it, it was, oh my God, what am I going to do? And what I did, because I was very afraid just personally of hospital kinds of experiences, that I needed to be able to get through it first before I could prepare Jordan for it. So I needed to acquaint myself. My own way of dealing with my anxiety was to get information. So I asked lots and lots of questions, and I wrote everything down. And before I knew it, it really became a guide, I guess, to getting through this kind of procedure. And then I loaned it to people, and then it became a book.
Wow. Well, how old was Jordan when all of that happened?
Jordan was 6 at the time that it happened, and that's, pretty typical. A lot of children are between the ages of 4 and 7, when they go through tonsillectomies. So he's much older now. I held on to this for quite some time before I decided, to clean it up and organize it and make it better. But for a long time, it just lay in my drawer, collecting dust.
Mm-hmm.
And every so often, I would add, little notes to it. But at first, it was really just a compilation of raw notes that I stapled together and I loaned to some of my friends, and they found it helpful. And then it was launched from there.
And then you wrote a book. Well, did you ever have the dream of writing a book? Were you ever a writer?
You know, it's interesting that you say that. I always loved to write. I loved the idea of using words and putting words down on paper. But I also loved the act of holding a pen and writing.
Mm.
And I guess I'd have to say that my first dreams of writing were when I was 8 years old. I had a friend whose dad worked for a company, and they had all of this surplus paper at the end of the year, and he brought it home for us, and we decided to keep our own diaries. Nowadays, they call them journals.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember it was 1961.
Wow.
When I was 8 years old. And I have to actually comment, when you were reading my bio and you said 30 years ago she got her master's, I was thinking, oh, my God, that sounds, you know, so long ago.
It goes by fast.
But I guess it really speaks to, you know, my experience mm-hmm. and having done this. And the first page in our diaries, we kept writing 1961, and we found out that if you write 1961, it reads the same upside down.
So
we were pretty infatuated with that. By day two, we were kind of getting over, you know, that novelty, and then we started to write about the things we saw, and they were as simple as counting number of worms after a rainy day, or getting a new haircut, or going to pick her father up at the train station. But I kept it. And every so often I go back and I read it, and I keep thinking, wow, you know, this was an 8-year-old's idea of what journaling was.
Mm.
And since then, I took a stab at writing some poems, never publishing,
mm.
but just because I enjoyed writing. And I've saved them. And then I guess as time went on, I enjoyed storytelling to my own children. So for me, it was fun to publish and actually see that it was well-received by other people rather than just my parents.
Right. So this really sounds like it was a natural progression then for you that you wrote this book.
I think it was. You know, it fulfilled a need for me. It lessened my anxiety, and it helped
mm-hmm.
My son get through, you know, the procedure. And then it felt altruistic, I guess, you know, to lend it to people who said, wow, thanks. You know, it helped with their children. And then at some point, I really did want to have it available to a larger audience.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess having it published was the next level of progression.
I imagine there aren't many books like this out there on shelves. And really, you know, you have made this about tonsillectomy and adenoidectomy, but at the same time, there's a lot of really useful information for parents that their child may be going through any kind of surgery or medical intervention.
I think it is. You know, I piloted it, you know, with some other families, and I had a couple of pediatricians read it, and they felt that it really could be applied to any surgical procedure.
Yeah.
You know, certainly not all of it,
mm-hmm.
but pieces of it, elements of it, and I think the premise that if you get information and organize it and present it to your child sequentially, whatever the surgery may be, that alone would be of major benefit
mm-hmm.
to the child.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know that I've heard or read that you say that one of the main reasons that you also wrote this book is just to really give parents as much information, and that knowing this and the parents having a good grasp on that information, children take their cues from their parents, so that tends to lessen, I guess, the anxiety. Can you kind of explain that a little more?
Yeah. I think, you know, I work with children on a daily basis, and I'd say in my private practice and in the school where I work, many, many children come in with symptoms of anxiety. And it doesn't mean that it's anxiety because they're going to be having a procedure. It may be anxiety about anything, about parental divorce or going to camp for the first time or a sleepover or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And any time where we can give a child information that would either challenge an irrational thought or take away some, you know, there's always a fear of unknown. If you don't know what's happening, you can imagine anything will happen.
Mm-hmm.
But if you prepare a child and say, no, this is what's happening, you know, this is what it is, this is what it means, this won't hurt or this will hurt, but, you know, I'll be there for you. You're equipping a child with, I guess, with the strength to prepare for what's coming and to know that they can get through it. So if a parent says, well, I'm not afraid, you know, I've learned that it's only going to hurt on the fifth day, you know, after you have it. Or I know it's going to hurt if we eat pizza, so we're not going to give you pizza. We're going to give you oatmeal and pudding and scrambled eggs. But if a parent feels confident in their information, the child will be less scared. You know, one of the things also, we know even about babies who can't even understand language, they will look around and they'll look to their parent, to their parent's facial expression. And even if they don't understand what's going on, if a parent looks worried, a child will then cry.
Can read that. Wow.
So by a parent being able to say, okay, this is what it is, and put it in perspective of the child's life, the child then feels confident that, okay, mom and dad are in charge of this, and they're going to help me get through it.
So even if the child understands or not, you know, it sounds like it's important that the parents actually explain the whole process to the child.
But not the whole process at once, because the child can't digest it.
Mm-hmm.
The parent needs to understand, know their child, and know at what stage they can give some information, and then at what stage they can build upon it. So what I had done actually in my book was sort of a timeline. You know, there's a progression in terms of what do you do as soon as you get your information, and then how do you introduce it globally if you have a lot of time. Initially, you know, what are the first things you say, and then what do you say next? And as you have completed each stage, you can then present the child with the next bit of information so that it's not overwhelming.
Okay. So you've actually then really set this up step by step with the most incredible or the most critical aspects of this preparedness program. And it looks to me like you've gone a month or two prior to surgery.
Well, I had the luxury, I guess, of having maybe 6 weeks advance notice in terms of making my decision. I wanted to get a second opinion. We had to wait until the surgical suite was available. So we didn't do it. It wasn't a crisis kind of situation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But somebody who doesn't have the luxury of time can pull out elements of this and then, you know, prepare the child accordingly. I did have actually a review. Somebody had contacted me and said, I only have 5 days. You know, can you ship a copy to me immediately and tell me what to do? So that parent, you know, took the pieces of it and accelerated it, probably, you know, didn't need the first few pages, which were the introduction, but launched more into the immediate kinds of things that the child was going to need. And what I tried to do, though, is really make it manageable. So all of that is inside of about 20 pages.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also, at the end, there's what I have as an ultimate preparation list or things that a parent can buy and should have in the house if they feel they want to be able to maximally make the child comfortable. There's a list of things that they can kind of check off and say, okay, I have this, I can do this.
Mm. Oh, that's helpful. Most definitely. That's a parent's dream right there.
Well, yeah, I'm trying to, you know, to make it organized.
Yes.
To, you know, certainly it's an event, you know, of major importance in the child's life, but if you can handle it as matter-of-factly as possible, then it doesn't add any drama or trauma, you know, to the event, and you kind of, you know, put one foot in front of the other, and you get through it, and you can complete it.
Mm-hmm.
So my goal is really to help a family complete it with as few lasting effects as possible, reducing their anxiety as much as possible in advance of the procedure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, I want to talk physiology a little bit here. Can you maybe refresh our memories of what tonsils and adenoids actually are? What's the function of them?
Okay. The tonsils are the pink bumps, you know, that you can see if somebody opens their mouth.
Mm-hmm, on the sides.
Mm-hmm. Right, okay. And they're really part of the immune system. They help fight infection. They're located, you know, in the back of the mouth. And the adenoids are similar to tonsils because both of them are made of glandular tissue. The adenoids, though, are behind the tonsils and you can't really see them. But their job is to trap bacteria and viruses so that you don't get throat infections or lung infections.
Mm.
But sometimes they stop working if they get too full of infection and, you know, and they're saturated, you know, they don't work as well. And the American Academy of Otolaryngology, which is really considered the professional organization, you know, that makes recommendations, they say that certain numbers of these kinds of infections over time suggest that a child would be better off having them removed.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, how many times did your son have problems with his tonsils?
Well, in 1 year he had 6, and I remember that was the point that the doctor said, you know, to do it. But the Academy indicates that if they have 7 sore throats in 1 year,
mm-hmm.
or 5 in 2 consecutive years, or 3 in each of 3 years, mm-hmm. that child's probably a candidate for surgery. So my son had 6 in 1 year, and certainly he had had many before that. And he wasn't gaining weight properly.
Mm.
And he had other symptoms. You know, children who have infections often have poor eating habits. Food doesn't taste good. They'll have chronic bad breath, painful swallowing. Each of the symptoms are different. For tonsils, inflamed tonsils or tonsillitis, they'll have painful swallowing, sore throats. You can, during an episode of tonsillitis, they'll have a fever, headache, sometimes stomach aches. And then the adenoids are really related to things like breathing. You know, if they're large, then you'll hear a child breathe. There's mouth breathing,
mm-hmm.
you know, rather than nose breathing. And they're snoring at night. And most
mm-hmm.
children do not snore at night on a regular basis
mm-hmm.
unless there's some sort of an obstruction. And the other thing which is really dangerous, and that would be sleep apnea, and that's when a child stops breathing during the night.
Wow.
So if children have any of these symptoms, we usually, a pediatrician will usually encourage them to go for a consultation with an ENT doctor.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, I've heard statistically there's something like 250,000 tonsillectomies performed every year.
Yeah. Nowadays they are. The numbers were higher back in the late 50s. There were even more. Right now, tonsillectomies account for about 250,000 surgeries performed on children each year. But when you combine the tonsillectomy and adenoidectomy in the same procedure, then the numbers jump up to 400,000, and that's
wow.
just in the United States.
That's amazing. Is there any idea why those statistics are so high?
I don't know, actually. There was a movement to reduce the amount of surgeries based on some studies that were done in other countries. However, we've learned that people don't need their adenoids. After the age of 7, they tend to shrink anyway.
Mm.
They don't form a function.
Mm-hmm.
So there's generally a group opinion among ENTs that removing it doesn't have any deleterious effect. But you don't want a child to continue to have ongoing sore throats.
Infection,
It interferes with weight gain and, you know, their general health and compromises the immune system.
Definitely. Well, how much pain is involved when we're talking about the surgeries for this?
For children, they're always put asleep. You know, for adults, they can do a tonsillectomy sometimes without general anesthesia. But children are under anesthesia. So during that, the actual surgical procedure, they don't feel pain. When they wake up, their throat is scratchy, and then they'll have some side effects of anesthesia. You know, they may be nauseous. They may feel cold. They'll just really feel pretty crummy,
mm-hmm.
And then, you know, they'll continue to have a sore throat for several days. After about 10 to 14 days, they should be pretty much back to normal and back on a regular diet and back to some, you know, most of the activities they used to engage in. But for some reason, around the 5th day after surgery, children complain of the most pain.
The 5th day. I wonder what's happening on the 5th day.
I'm not sure. You know, and I'm not a physician, so
mm-hmm.
I couldn't answer that, but I know that they get white, crusty scabs, you know, on their throat, and until those scabs are formed and then gone, then a child is really not cleared for full activity. So there's something to do with the healing process and the scabbing.
So how long are they keeping children in the hospital? Is this a one-day inpatient?
Yes. No, one day, usually outpatient.
Outpatient, right.
Mm-hmm. Right. There's a lot of surgery centers that are doing it. Occasionally a child may stay over, but for the most part they don't.
So what is typically your first advice to parents when they discover that their child is going to have this surgery? You know, in advance, not that it's at a crisis point, but, you know, like you and your experience with a 6-week.
I guess my first bit of advice is do nothing, say nothing, just you'll be getting your information or the recommendation for surgery at the time that you've taken your child for a consultation with the ENT doctor. And at that point, if they're recommending it, I think you really need to take your child home and talk about it with anybody else who would be helping you to make that decision about surgery. Contact your pediatrician, talk to each other, read a little bit about it, but don't discuss it with the child. You also have to remember that you may be in shock at a time like this, and you don't have your information unless you've gone through it already with another child. This is a new area, you know, and as parents, we're always learning new things. Whatever your child's issue is what you become expert in.
Mm-hmm.
The time that they go through it. So I would say, you know, gather your information before you make a decision and tell, if your child asks what's happening, nothing yet. But you also have to remember that you're dealing with a sick child. So to compound the information you give to your child, besides the fact that, okay, you know, they're sick, to give them information or make them anxious at a time when you're not clear, it's not going to be helpful to them.
Yeah.
You want to let them know, okay, we have made the decision and this is what's happening. You also don't want to give information that you're going to, at some point, need to retract, because then a child will say, okay, well, maybe if I'm good, or maybe mommy will change her mind and I won't have to go. The parent needs to be firm and strong. Firm, you know, not punitive, but firm in saying, no, you know, mommy and daddy, or, you know, mommy and grandma decided that we spoke to Dr. So-and-so, and we need, we're going to take out your tonsils and your adenoids because we want you to feel better, and we know that you really feel pretty crummy a lot of the time. So we found a way to fix it, and Dr. So-and-so is, you know, going to be the one who's going to help us do that.
Mm-hmm. You know, this must be, for a first-time parent going through that, this must be really one of the first big medical issues that they're having to deal with their children. So this must be so scary.
I think it is. It was certainly for me.
Yeah.
I had my own tonsils out, and it was not a good experience.
Oh.
So, you know, I would, as I was going through it with him, I was having flashbacks as to what was horrible about mine. But then again, that was long ago.
Mm-hmm.
So
things have changed.
Right. Things have changed, but I still remember it. I was 3, and I still have memories of it.
Isn't that something?
And vivid memories. So I'm thinking, though, that, you know, if this, you know, the malleable brain of a young child, you know, can store memories, you know, about events or traumatic events, it's likely that my child is going to be storing memories of this event.
Yes.
So I want to try to decrease the chances of it becoming a traumatic event for him.
Mm-hmm.
I want to be calm, and I want to be able to walk him through it so that he will have confidence in me and the doctor.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Hi there. Are you looking for new ways to promote your book? Why not consider being interviewed live? With the huge impact internet radio as well as podcasting is making in our society, your voice can now be heard worldwide. Let Juanita at Inside Scoop Live create the necessary steps for you. You will not only receive a web page of your own, but your interview will be available for MP3 download and RSS feed. As well, your interview will be posted on venues such as iTunes, Blog Talk Radio, Podcast Alley, and the Inside Scoop Live blog. Go to InsideScoopLive.com today for more information. Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Just to remind you, I'm talking today with Dr. Lori Zellinger. She has just released her new book, The Oh My in Tonsillectomy and Adenoidectomy, and you can find out more about Dr. Zellinger through her website, drzellinger.com. Well, so aside from just having a traumatic memory from the experience, what else as a psychologist would you be concerned about that may show up later in life when that child is an adult?
I know, in fact, that there's a real good chance that the child might generalize that experience with medical procedures to other medical procedures.
Mm-hmm.
I've dealt with children who have had something happen to them that have required that they go to the hospital. Maybe they've needed sutures, they had a fall, or they had an asthma attack, or they've had something in a crisis situation. Whenever there's an emergency kind of situation, it's more likely to be imprinted and remembered, you know, stronger, because there's information coming from so many sources,
mm-hmm.
you know, the sounds and the sights and the feelings. So if they have had a bad experience with a doctor or with a hospital or with an ambulance or seeing blood, any time there is some sort of a trigger that shares any similar properties, you know, seeing blood again or going in an ambulance, that child is more likely to be afraid of what's coming ahead,
mm-hmm.
as they're more likely to be afraid than if they had not gone through something that left an imprint.
And so, and that adult may not even know where that fear is coming from, I imagine.
That's true.
Isn't that interesting?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we really want to make this, you can't make it, you know, neutral. It's impossible because it's a new event and there's going to be some pain and, you know, some worry and ahead of time, you know, children need blood tests and, you know, people are looking in their swollen throat. You know, there's a lot of discomfort just being sick, not even associated with the procedure.
Mm-hmm.
So if as much as we can neutralize this big event and make it as matter of fact, then the child will fare so much better.
Well, how do you suggest the parents deal with the pain factor?
Their physician or surgeon is going to prescribe medications to reduce swelling and to help with pain.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's one of the things. If you comfort a child and even allow them some things that they used to do when they were younger, you know, babyish, we know that when people are frightened, they show regressive behaviors. Lots of times when somebody is hit with new information or shocking or, you know, or destroying kinds of information, they rock. You know, people either rock or they go into a fetal position. We do this as humans. We seek comfort by doing things that are repetitive, that, you know, things that we might have done when we were younger. So I like to allow a bending of the rules where children can do things that were comforting to them when they were younger, giving them baby food, reading stories to them that they liked when they, you know, were little, tucking them in, giving them more parenting and more really good kinds of attention from us.
Mm.
It's, you know, I think it's really about helping the child feel understood and meeting their needs, anticipating emotionally what they need. So it's not just a matter of physically making them comfortable, but letting them know that we understand and we are trying to be as nurturing as possible,
mm-hmm.
during that phase.
Now, is there any concern during that phase that a parent can become too protective or that there be too much caretaking?
In my opinion, no.
Really? Okay.
Mm-hmm. I don't think so. You know, I think when a child has a need, the more the parent can attend to that need, the better off the child will be. And I'm talking about a need. I'm not talking about spoiling a child.
Mm-hmm.
But there are certain times in life when we have needs. If somebody can meet our needs, we come out better, and we're also better bonded to the person who's meeting the needs.
Good point, yes. So what can parents expect when their child comes home from the hospital?
The first day they may experience nausea, so the child may be vomiting. the sleep-wake cycles will be interrupted. So they may sleep a lot in the day, they may be up at night. The child's voice will change, the quality of their voice. Sometimes right after anesthesia, children speak in a higher voice, they speak more rapidly. They often experience feeling cold immediately after.
Mm-hmm.
They may be cranky.
Oh, I'm sure.
yeah, for sure. And also, you know, you're inhibiting their mobility, and kids like to move. You know,
that's
what they do. If you walk into any pre-K or kindergarten room, kids are all over the place. But right after surgery, they're not permitted to move. Increased movement increases blood flow, and you don't want increased blood flow when you're trying to heal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, parents can expect the kids to, you know, feel crummy because they're sick, crummy because they've had a procedure, and also crummy because they can't do any of the things that they're used to doing or eating the foods that they're used to eating.
Yeah, that doesn't sound like very much fun.
No, it's not. And also, you have to think about the other children in the family. You know, you may see changes in them because you're suddenly not available to drive somebody to a soccer game,
mm-hmm.
you know, or to a piano lesson, or take the time to cook a hamburger. You know, you may make them a bologna sandwich instead. You know, the other children may feel robbed of your attention because you really, you know, need to give so much of it to the child who is needy at that point in time.
That's a really good point. So do you suggest that the whole family embrace this as a family issue and have the other kids get involved?
Wherever possible, but the only thing is you don't want the child who's just recovering to have close proximity to any kids that might be carrying germs because you don't want to introduce infection.
Mm-hmm.
So by the same token, your doctor may not permit other children in the family to play, you know, with this child or to play closely.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say as much as they can be understanding, but then I think a wise parent will also try to find activities for these kids so that even though it becomes a special, and not necessarily special in a great way, you know, but special in a different kind of way, time for the recovering child, the other kids need some other sort of activity as well so that they don't feel forgotten and so that there is an adult who's there to take care of whatever they may need. You know, it's just a regular part of, you know, of being a kid.
Yes. So after the recovery process, which I guess lasts up to 2 weeks, as you said, how can a parent bring normalcy back to the entire family after a procedure like this or any type of a surgery? Medical intervention?
First I'd ask if there are any restrictions. I would ask the physician because the medical needs are paramount. You know, that's the first thing the parent has to check.
Mm-hmm.
But then if the doctor does not restrict them in any way, I'd probably choose quieter family activities like, you know, renting a video or, you know, from the library that everybody can watch together, you know, sitting on the couch. Or maybe cooking something together. You know, some sort of family activity that would give everybody a role. You want to keep it quiet, even though the activity's quieter, even though after 2 weeks the child may be cleared to return to school, they won't be cleared for full physical activity. So you'd have to think of things that would not require the child to run or move or you know, be excessively active,
mm-hmm.
you know, reading a book to them,
mm-hmm.
Popping, you know, popcorn together, and anything that might put people in one room but wouldn't be an exertion.
Mm-hmm. So have you looked at incorporating play therapy into this whole process at all?
Well, I am a play therapist.
I know you are.
So when I work out, when a child is about to go in for any sort of procedure, the kind of play therapy I do is really one that's based on the skills that I've learned as a professional. However, it's usually a good idea for parents to use play techniques with a child just to acquaint them with the process. And I recommend things like once you get your information, getting dolls or puppets and acting it out. once, you know, if you give a child a puppet and you put a puppet on and, you know, you say, okay, let's act out what, you know, getting your tonsils out is like, then you can see if the child gets stuck someplace, is there a piece of information that they got wrong or they're confused about.
Mm.
It allows you through play, which is non-threatening. It's a child's, you know, natural, you know, tendency toward activity. It tells you what you need to clear up, what you need to clarify for the kids. So playing that out, I also use the game Operation, the Milton Bradley game.
Oh, great, yes.
Yeah, and, you know, that has, it doesn't have tonsils in it, which, you know, I may make that recommendation.
I wonder why, that's strange.
I know, but it is a man, you know, the character that you're removing parts from is a man, so I suppose maybe because, you know, adults don't get as many tonsillectomies as kids.
Mm-hmm.
But I like kids to play that because then it puts them in the role of removing that organ and makes them, you know, feel more in control of something that they really don't have any control over.
Yeah, yeah.
So I like playing that game, too. And for my younger kids, we take out the batteries so that there's no buzz, you know, that goes along with it because it really requires a lot of very good fine motor control.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as it buzzes, kids get scared.
Yeah.
So I don't want them feeling scared while we're playing. But then if they feel, you know, capable, you can always put the battery in later and add that as another dimension to the play.
Mm, that's interesting. It's not the most important part of what you're doing, though.
No, it's
yeah.
not. You know, I'd like kids to get acquainted as much as possible with the procedure ahead of time. So any way you can do it. I like the families to visit the place, to do something while they're there. Play a game while you're there. You know, go into the waiting room, watch TV, because most places have televisions in the waiting room, and
mm-hmm.
usually they're set up for kids, or play a game of cards, or do something in the surgical center on a different day, having nothing to do with, you know, when you have to go, just so that the child gets a sense of it being familiar
mm-hmm.
on the actual day of surgery.
I think that was, when I read that, I found that really interesting. It must be so therapeutic for the kids to go and experience that in a non-threatening manner.
Right. The more exposure you give to anything brings familiarity.
Yeah.
And familiarity lowers anxiety. And people, we know just, you know, from scientific studies that you experience your perception of pain is higher when you're feeling anxious
mm-hmm.
than if you're not. So I guess I'm all about reducing anxiety in kids.
So what was the most anxiety-producing part of the whole experience so many years ago for you?
Oh, gosh. When I had my tonsils out, the first thing I think was being separated from my parents.
Mm.
And nowadays they do let parents into the operating room, you know, with kids
mm-hmm.
until the point that the child is under anesthesia and then the parent leaves. But I was separated. I threw up after it and, you know, that was scary and I didn't have my mom holding my head when I was throwing up.
Mm.
And I was in a crib. I was three, but they had everybody in cribs with bars. It was painful. I also remember the anesthesia. I remember a mask going over my face and not knowing why and, you know, thrashing, trying to get it off.
Mm.
You feel powerless as a kid
mm-hmm.
and even more so when people are doing things to you that you don't understand and you can't stop.
Yes, yes. Now, when you went through it with Jordan and he was going through the procedure, what was your anxiety level like at that point?
Probably pretty high.
Mm-hmm.
I was worried, you know, everything, you know, would come out okay. I knew that it was going to take about an hour, but I still watched the clock every 2 or 3 minutes. I guess knowing that somebody is doing something, you know, I was powerless also. I knew that it would be fine. And I knew he needed it, and I knew that he and I were as prepared as we could be. And my husband as well, who, you know, took, you know, this much more in stride than I did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but he's less anxious than I am. So, you know, you introduce anything medical or anything unknown, and it's a little scary. I was gathering my information during Jordan's tonsillectomy, so I wasn't yet as skilled and knowledgeable
mm-hmm.
as I am now.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, it's still scary. And then when they woke him up and then they told me that they had to put him out again because he punched a nurse in the face.
Oh, gosh.
You know, He was 6 years old, and they came out, and they were miffed. And that's the polite way of describing it. But they said, you know, he punched somebody, and you know, a different nurse is taking over. We had to put him out again, and we'll wake him up again. And then they woke him up, and then he pulled the IV out, and you know, just nothing was going according to plan.
And that can happen coming out of anesthesia, from what I hear.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, and then I just, you know, kept thinking, okay, so, you know, what else? And
yeah.
I also kept thinking, oh, God, you know, what is the next, you know, week going to bring? Am I going to have the strength to do this? What other surprises? How is he going to be? And it turned out that it was okay. You know, we put a bell in his room so he would, you know, ring the bell or a xylophone if he wanted somebody. And, you know, I'd come running. You know, I kind of figured it out by going through it.
Does he remember any of that?
He takes a real pleasure in telling people that he hit a nurse in the face.
Yeah, I bet.
So, you know, I don't know. I don't know what he really remembers or, you know, what he knows just from our telling of it.
Mm-hmm.
He does remember, though, when the first time he was drinking through a straw, and then the apple juice came out through his nose, and that panicked him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot more room now in the back of the throat when you take everything out. And it took some adjusting, and that was a surprise. And I think, you know, the unexpected just kept frightening us at the time.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he was your first son. He was your first child, right?
Not my first child, but my only child who required a tonsil.
Okay, okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So now I would be better prepared, you know, if I had other children who were going through it. But, you know, we kind of learned as we went along.
Yes, yeah. And now you've written this book to help others on this journey. I mean, you've really covered all the bases with this book.
Well, I tried, you know,
yeah.
And as I loaned it to people and they had suggestions, I added it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because certainly everybody's experience has something else to offer. So I really tried to put in anything I could think of that might help somebody else.
Yes. Yeah, you know, you've really made a great contribution with this book. I think it's fantastic. I'm wondering if you are going to be writing any more books like this.
It's funny you should ask, Juanita. Actually, this son, Jordan, and I wrote a book together We wrote a manuscript together called Please Explain Anxiety to Me. You know, I guess I'm really focused on this anxiety thing. You know, I see so many anxious kids, and
yeah.
I relate to it because I was an anxious kid.
Yeah, and anxious kids make anxious adults, and you know,
absolutely.
Yeah, it's a really big
ferment. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So what we did, though, there are a lot of books on the market about, you know, somebody has a worry or, you know, things along those lines. But what we did was take more of a biological or a physiological approach. And it's a story that I tell to children who are in my practice in terms of why do we have anxiety? And we wrote this manuscript where where dinosaurs are the main character, and the reason for anxiety is really because it was protective. You know, and I talk about the freeze, flight, or fight kinds of reactions and how it can be adaptive, but many times we feel anxiety and it's not adaptive. This anxiety switch is going on, and it shouldn't be on, and it makes us feel pretty horrible. So I give the biology of it in very simple terms, and I also suggest ways that a child can control it when they don't need to be anxious.
Mm.
So we have written it. I haven't yet found a publisher for it. But I would like to get it published because I think that there's some good information in there.
It sounds like it. Mm-hmm.
And it's not things that are covered by other children's books.
Will it be in the same format as this one you just released?
The one that I released is a parent manual,
mm-hmm.
but the one that Jordan and I have written is really geared for adults to read to children.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And by the same token, though, I did, I was part of the editorial development of an American Girl book, which is going to be released this spring, and that's called The Smart Girl's Guide to Staying Home Alone.
Okay.
And the piece of it that I made a contribution to is regarding helping a child to feel safe if they feel anxious when they're alone.
Oh, interesting. Is this the series of this book, the American Girl book?
Yeah, it's linked with Mattel, and there are several books on the market. I was only asked to review and to contribute to this one.
Okay.
I also should probably say that it's written by Dottie Raymer with illustrations by Lauren Scheuer. And the whole title is A Smart Girl's Guide to Staying Home Alone, A Girl's Guide to Feeling Safe and Having Fun. Mm-hmm. So I haven't seen the complete book yet because mm-hmm. It hasn't been released. But I'm very much looking forward to that. And I've done a couple of other things. I just submitted a book with Charles Schaefer. He had written a book called Cat's Got Your Tongue,
mm-hmm.
which is about selective mutism. That's when children have the ability to speak, but don't speak in social situations. And we just rewrote it. So we wrote a revision of that book, and that was submitted for publication just about 2 weeks ago.
Oh, well, congratulations.
Thank you. And I just finished a chapter for a book by Athena Drews and Charles Schaefer called Play-Based Interventions in School, second edition. And that's about using play techniques in a school setting for children with selective mutism.
Okay.
So I have a couple of things. And I'm quoted frequently in magazines and articles and online kinds of venues.
But it sounds like you are really taking a new aspect of your career here with book writing.
I like writing. You know, I found that a lot of people do a lot of fun things in their free time. And for me, it just seems like writing is fun. You know, that's what I like to do when I have some downtime.
Mm-hmm. Well, wonderful. Well, we're going to be hearing more about you in the future then with all of these books coming out.
Well, thanks, Juanita. I hope that they do get picked up by, at least, the one I wrote about anxiety that does get picked up for publication.
Mm-hmm. It will, most definitely. Yeah, great. So your website then is, let's mention it again, it's drzellinger.com.
Right, and Zellinger has one L. It's Z-E-L-I-N-G-E-R.
Okay.
And I have to tell you that when I was married to my husband for 3 weeks, we're now married 28 years, very happily.
Good for you.
thanks. But when we're married 3 weeks, I called him up and I said, how many L's in Zellinger? Because everybody's sending me mail with two L's. No, one. So Zellinger is Z-E-L, one L-I-N-G-E-R.
Great. And your book can be purchased through your website.
Through my website and Barnes & Noble and Amazon and through the publisher,
okay.
Loving Healing Press.
Okay. So you're all over the place.
Well, starting.
Yeah. That's wonderful. Well, I am just so thankful that you joined us today. You were just full of information, and this is very useful information for parents. So we really recommend that our audience look for your book and go to your website. I know you send out newsletters as well they can sign up for.
Oh, well, I write a humor column. I really believe in using humor when you work with children, when you work with anybody, and not derogatory humor, but, a good-hearted humor.
Mm-hmm.
And I write a column for the Play Therapy newsletter for the New York State Association of Play Therapy. That's called Grin and Bear It. Excuse me, sorry, Grin and
Share It.
right. Because I keep thinking that anybody who has funny stories and anecdotes, that they've enjoyed when they've worked with children or families, I try to gather those and then I post them in the newsletter, just so that there's something lighthearted, in this world with such changing times.
Mm, that's great. And people can sign up on your website.
I'm not sure if they get the newsletter on my website.
Okay.
I don't know.
Well, we will have to check into that.
Okay. But actually, you just gave me an idea, so I will check.
Okay, good. Good. Well, Dr. Zellinger, it's been great talking with you. I want to have you back on the program. When you do get your book on anxiety published, I see that for you. So I just want to thank you for your time today, and all the best to you.
Thank you so much, Juanita. This was really a pleasure for me as well.
Wonderful. Take care.
Okay, you too. Bye-bye.
All right, listeners, that's been Dr. Lori Zellinger. Her book, The Oh My in Tonsillectomy and Adenoidectomy, How to Prepare Your Child for Surgery, is available now. It's out on Loving Healing Press. And you can find out more information about Dr. Zellinger through her website, drzellinger.com. And don't forget, that's one L. So I want to thank you for tuning in to Inside Scoop Live today. I'm Juanita Watson. Until next time.